Thanks for joining us today. You're listening to Dan's Garage Radio, the premiere edition. Certainly appreciate you spending some time with us. Well, if you haven't figured it out by now, my name is Dan, and you're listening to my radio show, Dan's Garage Radio, broadcast, recorded, and produced in my lovely two-car garage in beautiful, beautiful Elk Grove, California. Elk Grove, California, for those of you who are geographically challenged, and why shouldn't you be? Who in the hell knows where Elk Grove, California is? Elk Grove, California is in Sacramento County. We're about 13 miles south of the capital in downtown Sacramento. It's a vast suburban wasteland. Nonetheless, this is where I live, and this is where I'm going to produce my radio program. I hope to produce, I'm actually producing it right now, and I'm recording it. I hope to distribute this program to non-profit, non-commercial radio stations via the internet on radioforall.net. So just as a shout out, all the music that you'll be hearing today is from a local Elk Grove group called Burgundy, and you can look them up at MySpace/BurgundyCali, C-A-L-I. They're an up-and-coming group. They play venues around the Elk Grove and South Sacramento and in the San Joaquin Valley. The music's quite good, actually, even for an old fogey like me. So it's royalty-free, so you don't have to worry about paying these guys royalties yet. That may change someday. So now that we got our thank yous to Burgundy out of the way, let me tell you a little bit about what I hope to accomplish on this program, a little bit about myself, and what we'll cover on a day-to-day, or not day-to-day, a week-to-week basis. My name is Dan. I formerly was with a program that was distributed on radioforall.net and heard on a few stations, a few low-power FM stations, community stations, called Left Turn on Bird Street. Left Turn on Bird Street was broadcast and produced from KRBS in Oroville, California. KRBS was one of the first low-power FM stations in the country, still in existence. Oroville is quite a ways north of Elk Grove. It's about 75 miles. I did the program with my colleague, Tom Nadel. So let's go over some of the unemployment numbers released today, Friday, March 6th. Nationally, the U.S. jobless rate is 8.1%. It's the highest since 1983. Before I give you some of the other unemployment rates, let me just say, in my opinion and the opinion of many more qualified, more knowledgeable, more academically trained economists, I believe the government way underreports unemployment. They don't include, for example, people who are underemployed who would rather work full-time but they're only working part-time. It does not include discouraged workers, people who have been unemployed for more than a year, have basically given up looking for work. In fact, I was at a meeting in Elk Grove, and I was talking to an analyst from the EDD, which is California's version of Employment Development Department, the Unemployment Office, if you will. And she said she felt, from not only her position as an analyst with the Unemployment Department, but also her own personal experience with her husband, she felt that the California unemployment rate was more realistically probably around 14 to 15%, rather than its official 10.1%. So, getting back on track here. Nationally, we have an unemployment rate of 8.1%, highest since 1983. Another bullet point, 651,000 jobs were lost in February, and December and January revised deeper, larger numbers. Since the recession officially began in December 2007, 4.4 million people have lost jobs. 4.4 million, that is a lot of people. Let me go over some of the other unemployment rates just to give you an idea. At least here in California and a couple other places, well, one other place outside of California. California, it's hard to get an accurate rating or reading. I've read 10.1% and 10.6%. And we're going to use the person I referenced earlier, the analyst from the EDD. I'm going to go with the 10.6% unemployment rate in California. Let's do some counties here in California. In Sacramento County, the unemployment rate is 10.4%. And if you think about it, that's really astounding because Sacramento County is a company town, the company being the state government. Even though the state has furloughed workers, initially they were furloughed 2 days a week, now it's down to 1 day a week. To have an unemployment rate in the state capital where a vast number of employees work for the state at 10.4% to me is really astounding. Here's another one, Monterey County. You're in Monterey, what do you think of the beautiful city of Monterey, the aquarium, the beautiful coast? It's a gorgeous place, it really is. You know what the unemployment rate in Monterey County is? 15.9%. I was astounded when I heard that. Fresno County. Now, Fresno County does have chronic unemployment problems down there. They have a migrant workforce and a seasonal workforce with the in the agricultural business. If the states do, if the state were to have a 4 or 5% unemployment rate at full employment, Fresno is always going to be about, 2 or 3 percentages behind that. Last reported figure for Fresno County unemployment rate in Fresno, 15.7%. Another county with high unemployment rate in the agricultural belt of California is Kern County. Kern County has an unemployment rate of 13.8%. And here's another county that is really quite interesting, has made the national news. If I'm not mistaken, President Obama made a trip there recently because of the unemployment rate there. Elkhart County, Indiana has an 18.3% unemployment rate. Now, I don't know about you, but once we start getting counties with unemployment rates that are out of the single digits and in the double digits, in my estimation, in my book, we're no longer in a recession. We are in the grips of a depression. Are we in the depression like the, I don't like this, but the Great Depression of the 1930s? I don't think we're there yet, but you know what? I think we're headed there real quick. So, if you're to believe me and believe a few brave economists out there, we are in a depression. How long this depression is going to last, no telling. Some people, the optimists, usually real estate agents and Wall Street types, think, well, prosperity is just around the corner. We're going to be out of this thing no time. But the one other aspect that makes this most troubling for not only homeowners, who've lost a great deal of wealth, but anybody out there who has a retirement plan. And as we all know, most people who have retirement plans, where are their Bueller? Anyone Bueller? Where are all those monies and retirement plans tied up in? Anyone Bueller? Of course, they're in 401k plans. And the vast majority of the 401k plans are, the funds are tied up where? The stock market, of course. So unless you've been hiding under a rock for the last 3 or 4 months, it's hard to miss that the value of the stock market is now down to values not seen since 1929. 96 or is it 97? I want to say it's 96. They basically lost over 13 years of value in the last year. So anybody, I feel particularly bad for anybody who's nearing retirement in the next 3 or 4 years. Your portfolio has probably been wiped out. If it was worth $1,000 last year, it's only worth $500 now, and you're screwed. And what does that mean to you and me? Well, it means that we're gonna have to work longer. We're gonna have to wait and defer retirement. And what does it do for Social Security, Medicare? I mean, these are questions that are kind of out there that aren't being addressed. But I don't want to be all doom and gloom. I don't want to be accused of being Dr. Doom or Mr. Depressing. I'll get the real estate people out after me, and they'll say you're driving the values of prices down in your neighborhood with this talk. So I did find a little, we got to look at the humorous side of things. After all, turn that lemon into lemonade. Turn that frown upside down. I found an interesting story in the New York Times. It's called Slump Humbling Blue Chip Stocks Once Dow's Pride. And basically, the story talks about how members, companies, members of the Dow Jones Industrial Average are now trading at historic lows. And let's give you a few examples. They're kind of funny, actually. A share of General Motors stock, which fell below $2 Thursday as it warned of a possible bankruptcy, is now not enough to buy a gallon of gas for your Chevy. Think about that. You go out and buy, this is once the greatest industrial company in the world. Wasn't it, they said what's good for GM is good for the country or something like that? Shares are below $2. So if you sold one share of General Motors stock, you couldn't even buy a gallon of gas with it. Well, maybe you could if you're in Oklahoma or Texas. Okay, how about this one? GE, a share of General Electric, battered this week to a little more than $6. Imagine that, GE. I mean, that's the bluest of the blue chips. That $6 share would not be sufficient to buy two of the company's compact fluorescent light bulbs. And its current price is 73 cents. It would take several shares of Office Depot stock to buy a box of paper clips. So, okay, let's see. You need to get a box of paper clips. You own shares of Office Depot. What does a box of paper clips cost nowadays? $3, $4? Let's go $3. You're going to have to basically redeem 4 shares of Office Depot. Think about that. That's astounding. Here's another one. I don't think they have it listed in this story. I just know this one from my own experience. Not experience, my own knowledge. For those of us here in Sacramento in the Central Valley of California, we have the Sacramento Bee, we have the Modesto Bee, we have the Fresno Bee. They're all owned by a company based here in Sacramento called McClatchy News. And up until a year or two ago, McClatchy was kind of a regional player. They had some dailies in California, I think one in North Carolina. They bought the Minneapolis newspaper. They had a paper up in Alaska, and they were a little bit of a player. But by God, they wanted to get in the big time. They wanted to get up there with the big boys. So what did McClatchy do? In their infinite wisdom, they purchased for I don't know how many billions of dollars. Put it like this, I think they have about $2 billion of debt on their books now. They purchased the parent of the San Jose Mercury News, and the San Jose Mercury News is actually a very, very fine newspaper. But they purchased Knight Ridder. So they purchased it at the peak of the stock market. They took on all this debt. Now they can't get the debt refinanced. The debt's coming due. And shares of McClatchy in the last 52 weeks were trading for as high as $12 a share. And if memory serves me, in the last 5 to maybe 10 years, I believe those shares in McClatchy were even valued as high as $50 a share. Last time I checked, which was yesterday, I think McClatchy, and you can look it up on your computer. The symbol is MNI. I think they're trading for about 45. Well, continuing on here with the terrible economic news. Is there any other type of economic news nowadays? I guess there really isn't. There's a story I came across, or I actually heard about a week ago, and I know for my friends on Low Power FM, this might be poison to their ears, but it was really a well-done story on NPR. The title of the story was called "Taxpayer Beware, Bank Bailout Will Hurt." And the basic crux of the story was how you and me are going to be paying for all these bailouts of banks and AIG and, you know, all the other guys on Wall Street who thought they were the master of the universe when, in fact, they were no better than the hobo along the railroad track. In fact, that you probably argue the hobo along the railroad track probably is better than the guy on Wall Street. Nonetheless, this story was really interesting because there was a point in the story where they interviewed a former banker who surprisingly didn't think that the banks were totally to blame. I don't know if I necessarily want to agree with him, but he does have some good points. And he presented a thing he called Twin Peaks. And I'll read a little bit of the copy from the story. And this section is called, not surprisingly, Twin Peaks. It reads, David Beam, a former banker who is now a professor at the Columbia Business School, has something to say for people who want to pin the whole thing on the banks. He has a chart illustrating how much debt American citizens owe, how much we all owe, with our mortgages and credit cards, compared with the economy as a whole. For most of the American history, that consumer debt level represented less than 50% of the total U.S. economy as measured by the gross domestic product. And then, quote, from 2000 to 2008, it's almost a hockey stick. It just goes dramatically upward, Beam says. It hits 100% of GDP. That is to say, currently consumers owe $13 trillion when GDP is $13 trillion. That is a ton. This has happened before. The chart, which I can't show you because we're on radio, shows two peaks when consumer debt levels equaled the GDP. One occurred in 2007, about a year and a half ago, and the other in, surprise, surprise, 1929. And that scares Beam. Beam goes on to say, that chart is the most striking piece of evidence that I have that what is happening to us is something that goes way beyond toxic assets and banks. It's something that has little to do with the mechanics of mortgage securitizations or ethics of Wall Street or anything else, Beam says. It says, the problem is us. The problem is not the banks, greedy though they may be, overpaid though they may be, the problem is us. We have overborrowed, Beam says. We have been living very high on the hog. Our living standard has been rising dramatically in the last 25 years, and we've been borrowing much of the money to make that prosperity happen. In other words, the problem the banks are facing is the problem we as a society are facing. We all have too much debt, and getting rid of it is going to be painful. Now, I don't necessarily agree with him when he says that the banks aren't greedy and they shouldn't be held to account. They should be held to account. You know, they by and large got us into this trouble. But his other point is well taken. And you know, I can recall in the last several years here in the vast suburban wasteland of Elk Grove. My wife and I, you know, we both have decent incomes. We have a decent house and we have a decent life. There's a lot of people in our neighborhood who maybe they're making more money than us, but I don't think they're making that much more money would be tooling around in these huge, stonk, honking, stinking SUVs. I mean, these are things that cost $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. And I often wonder, where are these people getting this money from? Well, surprise, surprise, they're getting it from the ATM, or more commonly known as home equity loans. And you know, it's like the old saying, I've seen the enemy, and the enemy is us. Well, seeing how the first 20 minutes of the premiere show of Dan's Garage Radio, broadcast from my garage in beautiful Elk Grove, California, have been dedicated to the sick economy we find ourselves in, we might as well go for another 8 or 9 minutes and talk about the economy a little bit more. This time I want to focus a little bit more on one of the beneficiaries of the taxpayer bailout money. No, we're not going to talk about Citibank or Bank of America or Merrill Lynch or Wells Fargo or WaMu or any of the other big, huge zombie banks that are running around. I want to talk a little bit about an insurer. Now, I'm not going to talk about State Farm or Allstate or the little lizard from Geico. I'm going to talk about everybody's favorite insurer, AIG. And AIG has really been at the fore of the entire financial crisis. Now, AIG isn't your typical insurance company either. It's the world's largest insurance company. You know, although they do have subsidiaries that are involved in your, you know, standard automotive and homeowners insurance, their big business really comes from insuring small businesses, municipalities, 401k plans, and Fortune 500 companies. Now, you may have heard that the AIG received some more federal bailout money this week. I think the amount of this latest bailout, I want to say, was 38 million, 35, 30, or I'm not million, chump change. I think it was a 38 billion, pushing their total amount of taxpayer bailout to $180 billion. Just think about it, $180 billion. You know, I'm not a, you know, huge defender of General Motors, but look at all the gyrations that we went through the Congress to get those $18 billion from General Motors and Chrysler. These guys, they're getting the money with no hearings, really no oversight whatsoever from the unelected officials at Treasury and the Federal Reserve. And there are a couple stories out there about AIG and the lack of transparency in this money. One in particular is real good. I found it on truthdig.com, and it's the title of the story is "Billions Dished Out in the Shadows." And let me just read a little bit of it for you. Starts by saying, "This is crazy. Forget the bleeding of Rush Limbaugh. The problem is not with the quite reasonable and, if anything, underfunded stimulus package, which in any case will be debated long and hard in Congress. The problem is with what is not being debated, the far more expensive Wall Street bailout that is being pushed through, as in the case of the latest AIG rescue, in secret, hurried deal-making primarily by the unelected Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve. 6 months ago, we taxpayers began bailing out AIG with more than $140 billion, and then it went and lost $61.7 billion in the fourth quarter, more than any other company in history had ever lost in one quarter. So Timothy Geithner and Ben Bernanke huddled late into the night last weekend and decided to reward AIG for its startling failure with $30 billion more of our dollars. Plus, they sweetened the deal by letting AIG off the hook for interest it had been obliged to pay on the money we had previously gave the money." Now, doesn't that just stink? I mean, they're getting not having to pay the interest. But I think the bigger story is something else. There's something else going on here, I think. And this is what I think is going on. AIG, through their credit default swaps, which were basically unregulated insurance policies that they sold to businesses, financial entities, government entities, 401k plans. These unregulated insurance policies are being called. I suspect this is what's happening. This is why the Treasury Department doesn't want to say who the beneficiary of this money is. I suspect, and I have no substantial proof, this is just my suspicion. I'm a suspicious, a skeptical type of person, but I suspect that the government is really using AIG as a sort of conduit to prop up all sorts of ailing Fortune 500 companies, municipalities, who had bought these treasury, or excuse me, these insurance policies from AIG, which were lacking any collateral, and now they're needing to collect. They're paying their premiums, and now they need to collect on these insurance policies, and AIG doesn't have the money to pay. If AIG doesn't pay these companies these monies, these host of companies and government entities are likely to collapse. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not an apologist for AIG. I just assume see them go out of business too. But really, what I think is happening here is because the government is purposely obscuring who is benefiting from this money. I think it's really a backdoor, a conduit, whatever analogy you want to use, that the government is supporting and helping prop up these companies. And if they don't, a host of companies are liable to collapse. Now, this is going to be a story that's going to develop. Hopefully, there'll be some good investigative journalism done on it, by whom I don't know. News bureaus are being ravaged as we speak. Perhaps Truth Dig can get into it. But I think this is something that everybody needs to talk to their congressman when they come back to their district. Where exactly is this money that we, the taxpayer, are giving the AIG? I think, and we're going to follow this story, I think AIG is simply be acting as a conduit for a host of other companies that are likely to collapse. And I think the government's doing this out of fear of a widespread collapse. And just one last thought on this. Why did this all happen? I can tell you quite easily why this all happened with AIG specifically. This is not necessarily with the foreclosure crisis or anything like this. This is just one of the problems. We can go tracing this back to the start of the Reagan era, but a lot of this has to do with deregulation of the financial markets. We've allowed companies to merge across lines that were previously imposed during the Great Depression, and now we're paying the price for it. Trust me, the situation is going to get quite ugly. But on that note, I'm going to have to sign out. This is Dan, broadcasting from Dan's Garage Radio in beautiful Elk Grove, California. We hope you enjoyed your time you've spent with us. We hope to be back for several more shows. If you have any comments, please email them to us at elkgrovenews@yahoo.com, and I'll get them and I'll gladly respond. Again, thanks for joining us, and sayonara from Dan's Garage.